You're listening to the 1 Peter 5 Friday Roundup. Hello and welcome to the 1 Peter 5 Friday Roundup, May 22nd, 2015 edition. The Friday Roundup is the mini podcast where we go back over the course of the week and look at the big Catholic stories in the news. I am your host, Steve Skojek. Let's get to the stories. The UK Catholic Herald reports that the superior of the Mar Elian Monastery near Homs in Syria has been kidnapped by members of the Islamic State. The report, which originated with the French newspaper La Croix, said that Father Jacques Morad was kidnapped from the monastery yesterday. Father Morad, quote, had apparently sent an email hours earlier to say that extremists had arrived in the town of Akhwariatan and were committing atrocities against the people there. The monastery of Mar Elian is linked to that of Mar Musa, a monastery near Damascus dating back to the 6th century, which was rebuilt under the leadership of Italian Jesuit Father Paolo Dall'Oglio. Father Dall'Oglio was himself abducted by ISIS 2 years ago. Well, it's shaping up to be a tragic day in Ireland. Voters are headed to the polls in a referendum on marriage equality. According to LifeSite News, with the passage of a popular vote, the measure will legalize same-sex marriage and threaten traditional marriages and families. Gay marriage advocates strategically pushed the same-sex marriage agenda using a widely hailed study published by California professors, which has now been retracted due to fake data. In an article at Alitea, writer Michael Cook references a petition that has been launched which says, quote, "This push for same-sex marriage in Ireland has not at all been a homegrown phenomenon, but rather a carefully orchestrated and massively well-funded assault on the natural family, coming from private American funding," end quote. The article goes on to say that, quote, "A charity founded by Irish-American businessman Chuck Feeney of Atlantic Philanthropies cheerfully acknowledges that it has poured about $28 million over the past 13 years into strategic LGBT campaigns in Ireland," end quote. The preamble of Ireland's constitution says this, quote, "In the name of the Most Holy Trinity, from whom is all authority and to whom, as our final end, all actions, both of men and states, must be referred, we, the people of Ira, humbly acknowledging all of our obligations to our divine Lord, Jesus Christ, who sustained our fathers through centuries of trial." And it goes from there. St. Patrick was said to have won many concessions from heaven pertaining to the preservation of the faith in his missionary nation and adopted home. He did so by prayer and penance, and according to the Catholic Encyclopedia, he received several promises from an angel of heaven, including that many souls would be freed from the pains of purgatory through his intercession, that whoever in the spirit of penance would recite his hymn before death would attain heavenly reward, that barbarian hordes would never obtain sway in his church. That one's looking doubtful. And 7 years before the judgment day, the sea would spread over Ireland to save its people from the temptations and terrors of the Antichrist. It is impossible to separate truth from legend in this accounting, but with the Archbishop of Dublin unwilling to tell the faithful how they should vote in the referendum, and with the Bishop of Derry saying that Catholics could back gay marriage in good conscience, it doesn't look good for the church's stand in Ireland. If I were in Ireland this weekend, I might be watching the sea levels a little more closely. With me today to talk about this is Hilary White, a Catholic writer who has covered life issues for over a decade for LifeSite News, and who now lives in Italy as an oblate of the monastery of San Benedetto in Norcia. Hilary is also one of my oldest internet friends, and it's a miracle that we haven't had a conversation on a podcast yet. Welcome, Hilary.
Hi. Hi.
So you've lived in England, you have Irish ethnic background in your family, and you know a lot more about what's happening in Ireland than I do. How did we get here?
Oh, dear. It didn't happen overnight. What was the guy's name again? Chuck Feeney? Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah. I've written about him and his contributions to the current situation in Ireland. There's certainly a definite, deliberate campaign going on funded externally, but certainly, with the help of Irish people who want to make these kinds of changes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very closely connected with the activists at the European Union. And Mr. Feeney isn't the only one. He's probably the one who's most brazen about admitting it. But, you know, we know that a man like George Soros has been training change agents in many European countries and funding their campaigns on a number of different issues.
Right.
I discovered his involvement, Mr. Feeney's involvement in Ireland, when I was perhaps the only conservative writer, with maybe the exception of David Quinn, writing about the children's referendum. And unfortunately, just at that moment, the issue of legalization of abortion had suddenly blared onto the scene, and the children's referendum kind of got put by the wayside. The kind of people who would have been active against it, hardly even noticed it. In fact, when they tried to set up a debate on television with the yes side, that was government funded, was funded by Feeney, was funded by agencies through the European Union, they tried to have a public debate on it, and they complained that there was no opposition to have the debate on television.
Of course.
You know, the lack of understanding of the average Irish voter on what's happening in their country and what's being done to them deliberately through this very carefully constructed propaganda campaign is alarming. And quite honestly, given the condition of the church in Ireland, I would say that the blame can be very squarely laid at the feet of the leadership of the Irish Catholic Church.
So do you think, I mean, is this happening because the average Irish Catholic takes for granted that the Catholic identity is part of sort of the framework of the country, or is it not even something that rises to that level?
It kind of depends on where you're from.
Okay.
You know, if you're from County Cork or Galway, yeah, a lot of that is the assumption that this is how we are. But if you're from Dublin, if you're a young person from Dublin, you are going to be like any European or North American city dweller. You're going to have all of those ideas. The media in Ireland is exactly the kind of media that we have in the United States, in Canada, in Britain, even in Italy. And they're saying the same kinds of things, exactly the same, what I think Ezra Levant likes to call the media party.
Mm-hmm.
You can see how that power has worked on the average citizen, but really they would not have had any power to I guess essentially brainwash people if the church had been doing their job since the 1960s.
Well, I mean, it seems like there's no resistance, right? I mean,
no, there's none at all.
I was just going to say, I mean, we have the Archbishop of Dublin saying, you know, I'm going to vote no on this, but I'm not going to tell Catholics how they need to vote. I mean, how do we get to that point?
Yeah, actually, the I'm not going to tell you how to vote thing is a very, very is a very familiar refrain. The Canadian bishops have been bleating that one out about everything from legalizing contraception, divorce, and homosexuality right up to embryonic stem cell research. I sat in a Senate committee hearing room once and heard a bishop whom I knew personally just parroting that same tired old refrain that bishops just love. Well, we can't tell you how to vote. It's up to your conscience. And just abandoning their post.
I mean, is the pretense for that they're hiding behind? Because in the United States, what they do is they hide behind their tax-exempt status. They're not allowed to tell people how to vote, or they'll lose their tax-exempt status.
They say that in Canada. In Ireland, it's actually, I think it's even more egregious, because in Ireland, that isn't really a political issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Holy Trinity's invoked in their constitution. It's a little bit of a different scenario.
But the fact is, the clerical establishment in Ireland has been missing in action on every political issue for the last 40 years, right up to the legalization of abortion. Where were they? What were they doing? And the difficulty is, of course, that especially with the issues surrounding homosexuality, it's not even, they will say, oh, we've lost our moral authority because of the sex abuse scandals and the abuse scandals. In Ireland, it wasn't just sex abuse. It was institutionalized psychological abuse of young people.
Well, I mean, I'm half Irish. They're good at it.
Sorry.
I said I'm half Irish. They're good at it. I mean,
yeah,
well, let's be honest.
Those reports that came out, those government-funded reports, I think they've almost been used as an excuse by Irish bishops to finally lay down any kind of responsibility they have in the public sphere. Say, we can't say anything anymore. Nobody's going to listen to us. And quite frankly, no one has been listening to them for 40 years.
Yeah, because you don't regain moral authority by exercising zero moral responsibility. That's not how you get it back. It's like credit. It's a bank. I mean, you have to kind of make payments on your debt and begin earning back the trust of people by showing that you actually can exercise leadership.
I'm going to give you a little anecdote to illustrate the mechanism of defeat that is built into a culturally Catholic situation.
Okay.
In Ireland, there has always been a pro-life movement, and with varying degrees of success. One time there was some law or some situation that was going on. So I was interviewing an Irish pro-lifer, and quite honestly, I can't remember what it was about, but this conversation really stands out in my memory because it illustrates the problem. I asked her, have you had any support from your bishop or from the bishop's conference or from, you know, the hierarchy at all?
Mm-hmm.
And she said no. She went on at some length to describe the bishop's complete indifference, their refusal to talk, their refusal to respond to emails or messages, their total absence from this very important issue. And when she had finished, when she wound down a little, then she dove in before I could really sort of ask for clarification. She said, "Oh, but you mustn't say that I said that." And I said, "Well, what?"
Right.
What? You've just put your finger on a major part of the problem. And she said, "Oh, well, yes, but we can't really be seen to criticize the bishops."
Of course.
Okay, you get nothing from them. You get nothing from them. You get no support. In fact, you get opposition in many cases, simply, if nothing else, because they put these bad priests in place in parishes who say this bad anti-Catholic and non-Catholic stuff.
Right.
And she was insistent. No, we must not criticize the bishops. And I couldn't get out of her why you mustn't criticize the bishops. It was just in there, so deeply ingrained in her brain, because she was a faithful Catholic. And
right.
That was the issue. The most faithful Catholics are so faithful and have it so well dug into their heads that the bishops are always the good guys, that even in the face of objective evidence to the contrary, she wouldn't say anything.
Yeah, I mean, they still have that sense of respect for the clergy that everybody else seems to have abandoned.
That, you know, in a normal circumstance, we're supposed to more or less have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But, of course, any objective observer of the last 40 years would know that is, those rules can be inappropriate and inappropriately adhered to.
Not to mention, I mean, you're talking about a mere observation of facts, of the the omission of assistance. It's not as though, you know, you're talking about Bishop so-and-so is, you know, whatever. You're saying,
well,
we don't get help.
In Ireland, there are some absolutely outrageous cases where you could talk about Bishop so-and-so. Here's an example. You've got a retired bishop who's still... he's 80 now.
Okay.
He's the Bishop Emeritus of Killaloe. Forgive me, Irish people, if I'm pronouncing that wrong.
Yeah, Killaloe. It sounds like a place in Hawaii.
And he retired in 2010. And I think this was about the time that this was that I was having this conversation with this woman. He gave an interview with the newspapers in which he endorsed abortion, legalized abortion.
Mm.
Same-sex activity, female priestesses, and then at the end of the thing, admitted that he hadn't believed in God for years.
Which, you know, it makes total sense that he's a bishop.
What do we hear from Rome? This is under Pope Benedict,
right,
that we all had such hope for. Oh, cue the sound of crickets.
Do you think it was a translation error? Something was lost between the Irish and the German?
Now, hey, watch it. But you see what I mean? You've got the most faithful Catholics in the country are the only ones interested, and they're a tiny minority, as they are everywhere,
right,
the only ones interested in defending the faith, won't defend it against the very people who are the greatest threat.
It gives an insight into the insidious nature of an infiltration into the church, because external attacks don't work nearly as well. In fact, they tend to bolster the faith. It's the interior attacks, because in these faithful Catholics, they have their hands tied. We're not a democracy. We don't have internal revolts.
Yeah.
This is a hierarchy. It's a monarchy. The authority flows downhill. So how is it that we're supposed to defend the truth from the guys we're supposed to be taking orders from? It looks like a mutiny.
Yeah. So there's the perfect example of how, well, I've said it for a long time, since the Vatican II asteroid, the devil has used the virtue of holy obedience,
mm-hmm,
against the faithful to destroy the faith.
Incredible.
Well, the fact is that the Irish clergy, including bishops, have not been teaching the faith,
mm-hmm,
since the 60s. And before the 60s, before that asteroid hit the church all over the world, I don't know what kind of Catholic culture they had, but it seemed like it didn't create a great deal of depth. I think
right,
everybody was Catholic. Everybody adhered to the cultural standards, the cultural norms of what their behavior was expected. I mean, you know, we're all aware of that kind of culture. Of course, television and movies have depicted it as wholly negative, and I think that's just a function of bias.
I think that it's more that it just hollows things out. When you have a cultural Catholicism that's taken for granted, what winds up happening is...
We had the same situation everywhere. We had people who were really, if it's true, the rumors are true, that Stalin sent his agents into seminaries in prominently Catholic places around the world, like Quebec, mm-hmm, and Ireland, and, you know, maybe even Malta, I don't know. Then, you know, they had a situation of the ordinary people being fairly easy to corrupt because they had no answers.
Right.
A small number of people were people like Frank Sheed, who were apologists, who knew their faith, who could be able to answer the at that time it was only Marxists and socialists who were making the objections. So they knew how to make those kinds of arguments back in the 30s and the 40s. But I think the average person was a sitting duck for it because they'd never been given a depth of spiritual faith.
Well, they'd also never been challenged. I mean, isn't that always what happens when Catholicism sort of becomes the de facto condition in a nation?
Well, yes and no. I think it's a danger to say that, because then we would say, oh, well, we mustn't ever have it will always create a danger to have a dominant Catholic culture.
And that's not what I'm trying to get at. I think it's more along the lines of, you know, what happens when a person, you know, when things are going well in your life, you tend not to pray as much as when things are
true.
Bad. There's just there's that sense of the better things are, the less we feel like we need to prepare ourselves for when things are going to be bad. And so what happens in a culturally Catholic nation is they can forget that they need to not just live their faith, but they actually have to be catechized enough to defend and spread it.
Well, and there's also the problem of the kind of faith that is just lived as a day-to-day routine.
Mm-hmm.
And
it can become empty, and
it can become empty.
Yeah.
And I think we saw a bit of that. Certainly the Quiet Revolution in Quebec. You know, I have a friend whose father was in the military, and they left Quebec in 1964 to be in a military base in Germany. And they came back to Quebec in 1972, and he said that his father was absolutely devastated because in that tiny space of time, the entire culture was completely devastated.
8 years.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And it just collapsed overnight. It was, similar things can be said about a lot of these, not just Catholic countries, but Catholic institutions, like the religious life in the United States, all these nuns who were teaching and nursing. How much depth of faith did they have in their formation? I know a Carmelite nun who said she started her, or pardon me, a Benedictine nun who started out her religious life as a cloistered Carmelite nun. She said that in their formation program, they were forbidden to read St. Teresa of Avila because, she was considered to be too spiritual and that they would start to have pretensions of sanctity. And, you know, she said that their formation program in the Carmelite convent was mostly externals. It was, you know, how to walk and hold your hands like a nun and the kind of things you said and did and custody of the eyes. And all
again, with cultural Catholicism, it's the superficiality. It's the going through of the motions and that's it.
I don't want to accuse the Irish of having a superficial faith until 1965 because, of course, that's just a ridiculous sweeping statement.
Sure.
But... you know, it does strike me that that kind of situation is ripe for creating the kind of result that we see today.
So we've had half a century of erosion. And I mean, this isn't unique to Ireland, but Ireland's situation as a Catholic country is relatively unique in the world.
Sure, and because it's also isolated. It's an island.
It's an island, and Protestantism, you know, with the exception of Northern Ireland, really hasn't made inroads. I mean, the Catholic majority of Ireland is still Catholic.
Protestantism has never made inroads with the Irish. It's been imported forcibly.
Sure.
So yeah, there was that to fight against, and I'm not going to get into the troubles and all the I'm not in any way qualified to say anything about it, but the Republic of Ireland started out as a Catholic confessional state, but these kinds of ideological experiments, even when they're on the side of the angels, they carry very dangerous seeds in them. And there's all kinds of historical threads that could be pulled to find out what kind of human agency created this situation. But what really strikes me is the information that I have had from a lot of people there who are priests and seminarians of the homosexual corruption of their seminaries. And the stories that I've heard, I'm not going to repeat, but they'll curl your hair.
I mean, it seems like this is universal, though.
Yes, yeah. Well, if you read, here I go sounding like a paranoid conspiracy theorist again, but if you
you're on the right podcast for that, so it's fine.
If you read the material produced by that's been released from the Soviet Union archives now, and if you see interviews with former spies and former KGB agents, they come right out and say, yes, one of our tasks was to use the promotion of homosexuality in those institutions, particularly in religious institutions, specifically in order to weaken the institutions.
Well, it goes back to Antonio Gramsci in the 30s in the Frankfurt School. I mean, they knew that they could not get people who lived in a Judeo-Christian culture to accept communism. It failed in Russia spectacularly. They had to impose their brand of Marxism.
The Catholic Church has always, I mean, obviously, especially in a place like Ireland, but around the world, the Catholic Church has always been a major target. And there's no question that the percentage of homosexuals in seminary institutions among the faculty is orders of magnitude higher than it is in the general population. It simply cannot be an accident. So there's all these historical threads that can be pulled, but to be honest, there is an element of, I would say, supernatural mystery about this, because we are not talking merely about a human culture. We're talking about supernatural realities, that the faith is a supernatural reality, and how can a strong Catholic society suddenly go down within a space of a few years, like Quebec? How can such an institution like the religious life suddenly burst like a soap bubble at the lightest touch?
And I honestly think that it's indicative of the fact that it's not as sudden as it appears. I mean, we've talked about this before. There has been a conspiracy to take down the church for hundreds of years. I mean, we can look at the French Revolution. And so
he came right out and said it. I don't know why nobody believes them.
Right. And so when you see an implosion that appears to happen suddenly, if we compare that to something structural or architectural, I mean, a building doesn't just collapse, right? You know, there has to be something going on the inside where this rot, you know, over time begins to eat away at the structural supports. And then finally, then you'll get a collapse. It doesn't happen overnight, you know, in a gentle breeze. There's something underlying, you know, this collapse that happened that maybe we didn't see coming.
Well, the thing is, there's a certain aspect of the human will involved in this. Christianity, as it was intended to be lived, presents certain very great challenges, as we know. Mm-hmm. And those challenges can be accepted or they can be rejected, but they're uncompromising. They're demands. And you can't just be comfortable, live a quiet, comfortable life. You have to rise to respond to those demands, to either accept them or reject them. So this aspect of human agency involved with this is very great. And once you've got a rival system, like this whole socialist notion that turned into the great sort of, I don't know, globalist leftist institution that we've got now, offering an easier way, people will be tempted to take that easier way. And if global socialism, if Gramsciite infiltration says, yeah, but you can also have your Christianity. You can just sort of have a nice, easygoing Christianity that just sort of lets things slide, you know, like the Anglicans, right? People are going to go for that. People are going to go for it. And even within the institutions of the church. And that kind of Christianity, the socialist compromised Christianity, is what the Irish bishops and clergy have been peddling since the close of the council. And with
Things go from here? I mean, this thing passes, right? I mean, it passes.
Yeah, obviously. Well, everything has passed. Everything. There's just been nothing to stop them.
And so then, you know, I mean, Ireland falling is a pretty significant canary in the coal mine.
Oh, yeah, that's why they've been going after Ireland. Boy, they wanted Ireland to fall. They understand that is a major symbolic victory. To turn that country around, whew.
I mean, I'm actually...
You want to know where they're going?
No, but it's rare for me, but I'm kind of speechless. Like, I just don't even know what to say other than this. We don't get out of this mess without some kind of major intervention.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, I want to focus on solutions and positivity, but I don't see it. I mean, barring some sort of chastisement, I just don't see that we can ever take this ground back.
I'll tell you, they're not going to take the ground in Ireland or Quebec or anywhere back until the church wakes up one morning and decides to start taking the faith seriously again. And mm-hmm. Of course, currently we have no signs at all that this is going to happen.
And so what's going to make that happen is going to be, again, going back to the prayer analogy I made earlier, we tend to pray most when we are in dire need.
Yeah. I just read an interesting article today, actually, in The Week, and it was a little bit America-centric, as American magazines tend to be, but it's called the Benedict Option, mm-hmm. where people are, serious Christians, are withdrawing from public life, and they're talking about, and you and I have talked about this before, about creating, I remember debating this, where is it better to stay in the public fight and continue, you know, trying to steer the culture back towards sanity? Or is it better to withdraw and go and create a Catholic enclave somewhere? Mm-hmm. And he's talking about this, about how more and more the religious right in the United States is withdrawing from the fight and saying, you know, the gay marriage thing is in half the states of the country and all over the world. It's growing an unstoppable train wreck. And they're talking about going off and doing the Benedictine option of going off into the woods and creating little, you know, Catholic paradises.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, except there's one thing. At the end of the Roman Empire, I was talking to a friend about this, and there's a problem with that. At the end of the Roman Empire, we were talking about the end of something. Something was collapsing. Mm-hmm. Civil order was collapsing. They didn't have time to worry about a few monks going off into the desert or into the woods to start a monastery. Right?
Right.
Nobody was coming after them. But what we've got now is not the fall of the Roman Empire. It's the rise of a new global super empire. And now they have satellite technology. They have GPS. There is not it's not possible anymore to just go quietly off into the woods.
No, and you read stories all the time about people who try to do this, and the next thing you know, they come up with some reason to take their kids, whatever.
Yeah, it's happening with the homeschoolers in Germany are getting thrown in jail.
Yes.
Similar.
And some of them have tried to come here.
Attempted in Italy. You're not allowed, as if you're a journalist in Italy, there's some kind of new rules that says you're not allowed to say anything negative or even produce a photograph that could be considered to be negative of a homosexual or a transsexual, so-called.
It's literally thought crime.
Yeah.
Well?
So, you know, the warlords are surprisingly united these days. They're not squabbling amongst themselves over the last scraps of a ruined empire. They're building a new, awful, totalitarian thing. And, you know, the lessons recently in Malta, tiny, tiny little Malta, used to be absolutely Catholic. It's the last Catholic confessional state in the world. And recently we had, in 3 years, we went from divorce was illegal to we legalized divorce. Now we've got the same kinds of transsexual, homosexual equalities laws that is outlawing Christian understanding of sexuality being publicly spoken. And again, the church, the clergy, the bishops are saying nothing. Now, Malta is a tiny little island with seriously, literally 400,000 people in the entire country, including immigrants. But it's symbolic. It means that they are just not going to let one single corner of the world alone.
Again, I don't know what to say. It's we live in interesting times.
Oh boy. Yes, well, I live in the Umbrian Mountains in a town with a stout stone wall around it.
And the thing is, I mean, you live in one of the last places there is to go. You know, people talk, I mean,
I don't know
you
how,
talk about
I don't
it
know
all
how
the
safe it is here. I mean, I was chatting with one of the priests that I know here, and I don't know. I think we were talking about the Charlie Hebdo murders in Paris. And I said, you know, we're not safe here, are we? He said, no, of course not. You know, you can drive to Norcia. You can fly a helicopter to Norcia.
You're modestly more safe.
Yeah, I don't know.
In part just because you're out of the way.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, you're not a strategic target. But, you know, here I live right outside of Washington, D.C. It's a great place
to don't forget, ISIS is in Rome. And,
yes.
I don't think it really matters what kind of flag is on the armored car if it comes up your highway.
That's a very good point. Hillary, I'm out of time, but thank you for your commentary on this from Norcia, Italy, all the way across the worldwide internet. Hillary White, thank you so much.
Bye.
Here at home in the United States, the National Catholic Register reports that a majority of judges on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals have rejected a request put forward by Priests for Life and the Washington Archdiocese to have a judicial review of their challenge to the HHS contraceptive mandate. The mandate as it currently stands forces Catholic institutions to provide health coverage that includes contraceptive services and abortifacient drugs. The ruling, which came from a 6-3 majority, stated, quote, "We concluded that the regulation challenged in this case does not, as a matter of law or fact, give plaintiffs' conduct the contraception facilitating effect of which they complain," end quote. Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life says that the group is already planning to bring their challenge of the ruling to the Supreme Court. This comes as news that a federal court has again denied the University of Notre Dame's request for a preliminary injunction against the mandate. The uber-left news website Salon has a piece of commentary this week by Patricia Miller, the author of a book called Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. Now, if you want to know what side she's coming from, here's a little excerpt from the editor's description of the book. Quote, Good Catholics tells the story of the remarkable individuals who have engaged in a nearly 50-year struggle to assert the moral legitimacy of a pro-choice position in the Catholic Church, as well as the concurrent efforts of the Catholic hierarchy to suppress abortion dissent and to translate Catholic doctrine on sexuality into law. So now you know where Miss Miller is coming from. Well, her bit of fantasy at Salon is entitled The Catholic Church's American Downfall: Why Its Demographic Crisis is Great News for the Country. And yes, you guessed it, she sees the recent Pew data on the declining number of Catholics in America, which our own Eric Sammons analyzed briefly last week, as a positive sign. She writes, quote, The big decline in the number of Catholics may give progressives in the church a critical boost going into this fall's Synod on the Family, which is part two of the historic meeting of bishops that Pope Francis called to consider reforms, like allowing the divorced and remarried Catholics to receive communion. For years, conservatives have pointed to the Catholic Church's relatively stable numbers during the Orthodox papacies of Pope John Paul II and Benedict as evidence that it is conservative policies that will ensure the future of the Church. But the evidence suggests that it's the lack of evolution on hot-button doctrinal issues that's precisely what's driving Catholics from the Church. But what's bad news for the Church may be good news for the country. For years, the Catholic Church's demographics, larger than any single Protestant denomination and located in key swing states in the Northeast and Ohio Valley, have given the U.S. Catholic bishops an outsized role in U.S. politics, which they use to espouse conservative positions diametrically opposed to those of the Catholic faithful. It was the same Catholic bishops who single-handedly made coverage of abortion in the Affordable Care Act an issue that almost killed it, and who ginned up the religious liberty meme to oppose both the contraception mandate and same-sex marriage, despite support of nearly two-thirds of Catholics on both issues. But now, with their flock fleeing, and Pope Francis espousing a more conciliatory form of Catholicism, less focused on the pelvic zone, The U.S. bishops don't look so powerful. And while it's too early to tell if and how the emerging bloc of religiously unaffiliated voters will flex their political muscle, any group that represents nearly one quarter of the electorate can't be ignored. End quote. As the flames continue to consume the Catholic Church as they grow larger, critics like Miss Miller are readying their marshmallows for roasting. Finally today, in a story that broke last Saturday, it was announced that radical pro-sodomy Dominican Father Timothy Radcliffe was appointed by Pope Francis as a consultant to the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. Father Radcliffe openly advocates for Catholic acceptance of gay relationships and identity, women's ordination, and the Eucharistic nature of sodomy. Remember, sodomy being a sin that cries out to heaven for vengeance. In response to this most recent appointment, which is only the latest in quite a number of questionable appointments during this papacy, I wrote an analysis on whether, in fact, Catholics have a right to criticize the actions or thoughts of a pope. The analysis is somewhat lengthy, but it draws from scripture, church doctors, and previous popes. The short answer is, yes, we can. And in fact, in circumstances where actions of a pope represent a scandal or a danger to the faith, we have a moral obligation to do so. You can read the full piece by clicking on the link in today's Friday Roundup post. All of this reminds me, today, it's Friday, which means it's $5 Friday. With only a week left to go in the month, we're only at 21% of our fundraising goal, and things are getting tight around here. If you enjoy our work and can make a contribution for as little as $5, please do so by going to onepeter5.com/donate. Recurring donations are preferred. Set it and forget it. That's all we have time for today. Until next time, I'm Steve Skojak. Thanks for listening.
Peter 5.